market rate, £3,000 a day. Were you signing Lionel Messi?
This is First Minister's Questions. Just once. Just once it would be nice to get a First Minister's answer.
Any political party in this chamber that was confident in their arguments around independence would not be desperate to deny the people of Scotland the right to make that choice.
The Steamy, a laudable production for The Scotsman.
Hello and welcome to The Steamy, The Scotsman's political podcast. We are live from the Scottish Conservative Conference, at least in terms of how we're recording this, because we're here in Glasgow. My name's Conor Matchett, I'm the Deputy Political Editor at The Paper. Here with me, as always, is Alistair Grant, the political editor of The Paper. We've been away for a few weeks due to staffing and holidays and all of that fun times, so there's lots to cover today. But we'll start, I think, with the chaos, the shambles that was the Prime Minister attempting to speak to Scottish media earlier today. Alistair, take us through, set the scene, set the context for us as to what happened earlier today.
It was probably the most shambolic thing I have ever seen at a party conference, I've got to say. So this was Prime Minister Rishi Sunak addressing the Scottish Conservative Conference, doing his speech and then doing a Q&A style thing on stage with the Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross. And afterwards, he was due to do a kind of media huddle, a kind of press Q&A with journalists following his speech. And Number 10 had initially tried to limit this to six hand-picked journalists, essentially, six hand-picked newspapers alongside Press Association, the news agency. And obviously other journalists, including us, the Scotsman, because we were not invited, we're not happy about this, and we're not going to accept that. So we gate-crashed it, essentially. And they had to U-turn. They were left with no choice but to just let us in.
There was a great moment, actually, which is worth mentioning, where we were following the Prime Minister as the Prime Minister's press team down some corridors within the Scottish Event Campus. And you, Alistair, you know, they were trying to stop us. There were arms out, and Alistair, political editor of the Scotsman, slithered past on the outside.
I don't like the use of the word slithered.
But, scurried past, maybe, scurried is a better way. It was quite dramatic, wasn't it, actually?
it was just completely shambolic. And then, to add insult to injury, the Prime Minister's team then said that they were going to cancel the press huddle, essentially. It wasn't going to happen, and that Rishi Sunak would only do one pool clip with broadcasters. They were basically saying there was time constraints. It was completely embarrassing behaviour, to be honest. There was then a massive row between journalists and Rishi Sunak's team. It wasn't clear what was going to happen. There was a kind of a bit back and forth. It was made clear to them that this risked becoming one of the main stories of the conference, this lack of transparency. Yep. And there was a vote among journalists, essentially, as to whether we would accept one pool clip with broadcasters, whether this was kind of something that we would accept as a route forward. And unanimously, everyone decided that no, we were not going to accept that. And there was then a massive U-turn from Number 10, from Rishi Sunak's team. And the original press huddle went ahead as they wanted it, which still meant that only those six journalists, only those six newspapers handpicked by Number 10 were able to ask questions. So it's the Daily Telegraph, the Scottish Daily Mail, the Press and Journal, the Scottish Daily Express, the Sun and the Times. I think I've got them all there.
And PA. Although PA didn't get a question.
PA didn't get a question. They were just going to be allowed in the room when no one else was. So everyone else was allowed into the room, but only those six journalists were able to ask questions. And there was quite a funny moment where a member of the Number 10 team essentially said, "You can delete all your tweets now about us restricting access," to which some journalists literally just laughed.
Yep.
So completely shambolic. It was just a self-inflicted injury, to be honest, and it has become one of the stories of the party conference now. I have no idea why they tried to go down that route.
Absolutely, and I mean, it's worth reading out a quick statement from the Scottish Parliamentary Journalists Association, which both of us are members of, and as are our colleagues in the parliamentary lobby in Holyrood, which says, "Journalists expect to be able to hold the Prime Minister to account when he is in Scotland as a vital part of the democratic process. Today's actions to restrict access are unprecedented and undermine that important principle." Now, it's worth mentioning that often what happens when the Prime Minister is in Scotland, as we've experienced before with Boris Johnson, is that they tend to come up, they tend to do a government announcement, and they might invite a local paper and one or two of the national papers to do a quick press huddle. But that's government business. This is party business. Prime Minister here to talk to the public in terms of the Scottish Conservative public and outline his plans for Scotland. It's one of those moments, wasn't it, I think, where we were all in there and we just heard Rishi Sunak talk about transparency within the SNP and the importance of being open and honest with people and voters, and yet his team were restricting access to him to ask key questions. His speech this morning literally started as Richard Sharp was resigning from his role as BBC chairman, which is a big political scandal for both the BBC and Mr. Sunak. It kind of undermines all of these arguments and the attack lines that the Conservatives have been putting forward around the SNP, doesn't it? And we'll come on to what's happened there later on, but it does.
I mean, I've got to say that. I mean, I've been covering politics in Scotland since 2017. From my experience, when prime ministers come up to Scotland, particularly from Boris Johnson, when he came a couple of times, I went to events that he was at. Of course, your time is limited. You do not have much time. But usually, it was everyone's invited. All the members of the Scottish Parliamentary Journalists Association are invited. That's the equivalent of the lobby down in Westminster. And basically, you just try and get a question in. And sometimes they do try and handpick the questions that are going to be asked, but usually journalists talk among themselves beforehand, so there's some kind of agreement as to what questions need to be put to the Prime Minister. But you also just try and shout your own question. And at party conferences in the past, I've never experienced them trying to stop journalists from getting into a room like that. It's just completely unacceptable, and I've never experienced it happening before at a Tory conference, at a Labour conference, at an SNP conference. You would not accept that from the First Minister if they tried to do that in Scotland. And it's just completely unacceptable from a Prime Minister. It's just, it's pathetic, to be honest. I don't know why they thought it was going to be accepted.
And it's worth reminding, you at home about the sort of attack lines that we've heard from the Conservatives in the last few months. Particularly, I think most relevantly, would be around the fact that the SNP were trying to keep journalists out of the hustings during the leadership election. This was badged by Douglas Ross, among others, as being the SNP scared of scrutiny. I mean, today is just a demonstration that it's do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's just completely backfired. I don't know if they came up and just thought that, handpicking journalists, they would be able to just take them away from the kind of main auditorium where the speech was taking place and get them into another room, and other journalists would just be okay with that.
Yeah, we'd be happy with
just,
it. Yeah.
We'd just accept that was happening. And I think I'm baffled that any press officer thought that was going to go smoothly. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone with any experience of the media would realise that other journalists are just going to gatecrash it. They're not going to accept being told, you can't go into this room. They're going to try and get in. It's the Prime Minister you're dealing with. It's not some random member of the public.
No.
It's a public figure who has questions to answer. And like you say, particularly on the back of the Richard Sharp news this morning, there's a clear public interest in all journalists being allowed into that room. You can't start picking and choosing who you're going to speak to at a party conference.
And it is probably worth mentioning that it was a slightly Pyrrhic victory for us as we were in the room when the questions were asked, but Rishi Sunak didn't really say much in answer to the questions that he was asked. I think there were three or four questions about devolution, about Lord Frost, about independence, about Richard Sharp. I think at least three of those had pivots to the cost of living crisis, which obviously have nothing to do with the substance of the issues. So we didn't really gain much from the less than six, seven, 8 minutes that we had with the Prime Minister.
I mean, no. I mean, to be honest, you sometimes don't. That's not the point, though.
That's not the point.
You sometimes don't from these things.
Worth saying what he actually said.
It's also worth saying that Rishi Sunak was asked about the chaotic scenes.
Absolutely,
and
he was, yeah.
Why he'd originally tried to only speak to a hand-picked selection of journalists, and he literally said that's completely wrong. And I'm sitting here talking to half a dozen journalists, as I always intended to do, as if none of the events of the last hour had happened, despite the fact he's talking to a room with two dozen people who were literally there as it happened. It was just completely bizarre.
And it's threatening to overshadow the whole, certainly day one of the conference. He obviously did eventually take questions, as I mentioned, but Douglas Ross has got a speech later on today that we'll obviously report fully on Scotsman.com and in the paper. But in reality, the substance of Sunak's speech, of which there wasn't a huge amount, apart from an attack on devolution as it is, or at least a suggestion that it shouldn't go any further than it does, it threatens to overshadow the point of this conference for the party, which is to set out their stall in the midst of crisis in the SNP.
Yeah, I mean, I did an interview with Megan Gallagher, the deputy leader of the Scottish Conservatives, just the other day, and one of the points she was making is this is a chance for the party to put forward an alternative vision from the SNP. They're trying to take advantage of the chaotic scenes within the SNP, and maybe even a chance to do a bit of a reset. Obviously, last year was extremely difficult for the Scottish Conservatives. We had Partygate, we had the resignation of Boris Johnson, we had chaotic scenes when Liz Truss had her short-lived time in power. They were just going from one bad thing down south to another, and there was a lot of fears about how that was going to affect them in Scotland. So they're trying to recover from that, and they're trying to, you know, get onto the front foot. They've got Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister. He's reasonably popular as Tory Prime Ministers go in Scotland. They are quite happy with him being in charge. So it was a real chance to put forward another vision, and it has affected that. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, tomorrow's papers will also include quite a lot from comments made by Rishi Sunak about devolution, like you say, that it's not appropriate to have any more powers coming to Scotland. Some of the comments he made about independence and about the higher taxation in Scotland and that potentially causing damage. All those comments will be reported, but you will also have this completely unnecessary row taking up newsprint and broadcast time as well.
Absolutely, and it's potentially it's a good time to reflect on the kind of atmosphere within the Scottish Conservatives at the minute, particularly in Holyrood. I wrote a story that many of you at home will have read on the Scotsman's website and in paper about mutterings, it was put to me, about Douglas Ross's leadership, that they're not very happy with how it's gone, particularly the tactical voting plea and the idea that Scottish Conservatives voters in Labour, SNP marginals, should vote for Labour and not the Scottish Conservatives went down very badly with the UK party. What's your sense of how the party is set? Because it feels to me as if they feel a little bit lost at the minute. They're lacking a little bit of direction. They're lacking a little bit of fresh ideas that could take on the kind of Labour change narrative that both Keir Starmer and Anna Sawyer are bringing to the table, and that potentially Douglas Ross is the wrong man to take them through that journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two points I've made. The first one is that with the tactical voting row, I think the interesting thing about it is that Douglas Ross was almost just saying the quiet part out loud.
Yes.
What he's saying about tactical voting is something you often hear from Tory politicians, but also some Labour politicians, basically saying that if there is a strong candidate in a certain seat who will be able to defeat, in their words, the SNP, if, you know, unionist voters coalesce around them, it's something that has happened. When we see that in the Holyrood election, it's something that has benefited the Tories in the past.
Yep.
So he's almost, you know, it's controversial that he would come out and say it, although I think he tried to backpedal on it later and say that it's not quite what he meant. And interestingly, when I spoke to Megan Gallagher, she was basically saying that, you know, Scottish voters are savvy enough to understand the political voting system, which is kind of saying that they know to tactical vote if that's what they want to achieve. So I think that row was interesting, but I think you're also quite right that they do feel a bit lost, particularly with Labour having this sense of momentum gathering around them.
Yep.
Keir Starmer very much seen as the next Prime Minister. Labour in Scotland hoping to capitalise on that. You hear a lot of optimism in Labour at the moment from people around Anna Sawyer, from Anna Sawyer himself, about the number of seats they might be able to win. So I think if you look at that general election next year, you would expect Labour to pick up quite a few seats. You'd even expect, actually, even if the overall vote share from the Scottish Conservatives went down, you'd probably still expect them to pick up a couple of seats in areas like Aberdeenshire, where there's those really slim margins that you're talking about. So there's definitely a sense that momentum is behind Labour, and I think the Scottish Conservatives, and I think they are kind of, you can see this actually in some of the stuff they're saying now, have to come up with a kind of vision, a policy agenda for themselves. They can't just rely on the fact that, like they have in the past, that if you are, you know, a unionist, if you believe strongly in the future of the UK, vote Tory. They have to have something else now.
Do you think Douglas Ross is safe as leader for now?
I would say that there's always whisperings. And whenever you've got a leader that's been in place during quite a turbulent period, there are always whisperings within parties. I can't see him going anywhere soon. I don't know who would be replacing him.
I was going to say, the bigger question, isn't it, is who would want the current job of Scottish Conservative leader, given the fact that they are likely to be out of government in a few years, potentially, you know, ploughing quite a lonely trade in Holyrood as a minority third or fourth size party. It wouldn't be a particularly fun job for someone from 24 to 29, say.
you would need someone to people to start to coalesce around an alternative that was offering a concrete vision or
they
a concrete
a
thing
Davidson.
they're doing differently. Yeah, someone who would be able to say, look, I'm the person who can lead us to victory, and I'm just not sure who that would be at the moment.
Well, let's now move to Westminster, where it's been a busy week. As we mentioned, the resignation of Richard Sharp this morning. Dominic Raab obviously was also forced to resign over bullying claims. It's been a tumultuous time, to say the least, in the House of Commons. So here's the latest from our Westminster correspondent, Alexander Brown.
Hello and welcome back to the Westminster Section podcast. My name is Alexander Brown, and it has been another pretty tumultuous week in Westminster politics. I think the main stories have been, no doubt, the ongoing spats within the SNP over the auditors issue. And then there's also Rishi Sunak's illegal migration bill, something that has passed through the Commons, but not without controversy. So firstly, I think it's worth getting into what's going on with the SNP and the fact that they have until May the 31st have auditors in place, or they will require short money and possibly not be able to pay their staff. The row that happened this week was Ian Blackford said he was told by his successor and the man who many feel kind of forced him out, Stephen Flynn, that auditors were in place. And then Stephen Flynn said, no, I didn't say that. Actually, I said that we were trying to get them. They had a big Barney, briefings against each other. And then they shared a picture together on the Commons Terrace with a drink. Because basically, I think they realise it's far more damaging to talk about these things, and it's far easier to bury them deep inside and not talk about them at all. But the issue is closed, at least when it comes to infighting, but there are still no solutions to the auditors. And the Scotsman revealed this week, not just to promote one of my own stories, that there can be no extension to the deadline. If the SNP do not have it, they will not be able to say, look, can we have a week, mate? I'm a bit short, but I'll have the money for you next week. That's not how it works. So trouble continues in the SNP. As for the Conservatives, their Stop the Boats bill, as it's being commonly known, a bit like the Brexit, you know, get Brexit done. It's better to have slogans than actual policy that works, and that's what they've tried. It passed only just actually, and not without some rebels from within the Conservative Party. And unfortunately, this also means, as the Prime Minister knows, that you will not be able to, if you are a child fleeing Sudan, where the crisis is at the moment, you would not be able to come to Britain. You would be deported. The Conservative Party know this. Amendments were tabled by some backbenchers, but they were then criticised for, you know, going against government policy. And actually, it's about stopping the boats, and then, you know, they'll soften it later. So essentially, the Prime Minister has caved to the Tory right and sensibles, you know, those far left wingers on the party, such as Checks Notes, Theresa May, say this is actually going to make things easier for the human traffickers, and they're siding with the human traffickers against those fleeing here for a better life. So all in all, pretty depressing. And they released also a horrible poster about it that depicted Keir Starmer basically saying, welcome in, come on in. But given Labour said that, you know, Rishi Sunak was fine with child sex offenders not going to jail, probably call it a draw. Things are bad. Things are always bad. That's your lot. And we lost the podcast awards. So all in all, thank you very much for listening. I've been Alexander Brown, and see you next time.
And thank you very much for that update, Alex. Well, let's move on from the Scottish Conservatives, given the other news. We have been away for a few weeks, and quite a lot has happened in the world of the SNP and the Scottish Government in that period. Obviously, Humza Yousaf is now the First Minister. A big changing of the guard there, even if it is the continuity candidate. But I think it was my last day before I went on holiday for a week and a half, we had the astonishing, genuinely astonishing scenes of the police erecting what is colloquially known as a murder tent outside the house of Peter Morrill and Nicola Sturgeon, arresting Peter Morrill, the now former CEO of the SNP, and also raiding the SNP HQ. Only for a week and a half later, the treasurer of the SNP to have the same treatment, be hauled into the police station, questioned. Should be noted, both Peter Morrill and Colin Beattie have been released without charge, pending further investigation. But the image of the ruling, the dominant party of Scottish politics being raided for potential criminality is something that I don't think either of us ever thought. And I wonder what your thoughts are on, I mean, you were there, you were watching police carrying these boxes in and out of S&P HQ. How damaging is this? And we can't go into a huge amount of detail about the police investigation, but the optics are terrible.
Yeah, I think it's a day in Scottish politics that I will literally never forget. Just incredible scenes, like you say, that blue tent, that blue kind of evidence tent outside of the home that Nicola Sturgeon and Peter Murrell share in the outskirts of Glasgow. As you say, I was there outside S&P HQ in central Edinburgh pretty much all day, actually. It's the police, more than a dozen police, went into the building. They were in there for a few hours and then came out, as you say, holding boxes. And it was just incredible scenes to have something like that happen. I think you can't have that kind of thing happen without it causing damage to the S&P. I think it definitely will have an impact to some degree on them. I think Hamza Yousaf probably has the worst entry that any First Minister in Scotland has ever been faced with. He had things like problems in the health service, a perception that education standards have slipped, the ferries fiasco. He had all these problems that the government was dealing with. And then separately, he's got all these problems within his own party. He had this divisive leadership campaign, more brutal than many S&P members probably expected. And then he's had this ongoing police investigation into the S&P's funding and finances and the arrest of Peter Murrell, the arrest of Colin Beattie, both, as you say, released without charge on the same day. But it's just been incredible scenes. And I think it's been interesting, actually, something we could maybe talk about, how Hamza Yousaf has reacted to that. I think on the day after, the day when police swooped on the home shared by Nicola Sturgeon and Peter Murrell, Hamza Yousaf, the new First Minister, held a really unusual press conference in Bute House, his official residence in Edinburgh, where journalists were basically invited in. There was tea, coffee, they could help themselves to Tunnock's caramel wafers.
Very on brand.
Sat around on sofas arranged in a kind of rough circle, and Hamza Yousaf entered the room. It was very informal, and journalists could basically ask questions on anything they wanted. Obviously, all the questions dominated by the extraordinary scenes of the police the day before. And it's just something that you couldn't ever imagine Nicola Sturgeon having done. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon never shied away from the media. She always did media clips, did long Q&A sessions with the media, but she kept reporters at a distance. She wouldn't have done something as informal as that. And I think even in Holyrood, you know, you've had press doorstepping Hamza Yousaf as he's been exiting the Holyrood chamber, and he's been stopping to answer questions. And there's been a lot of talk about whether that's damaging to the party, because some of the things he said has not been helpful. They've kind of generated headlines in and of themselves. But I think the only people who should care about that are spin doctors and party politicians. Everyone else should welcome transparency from the First Minister.
Absolutely. I think it's really worth mentioning, actually, that, you know, there's worth exploring his response to it in terms of the media, because he's been understandably kind of mocked for some of the phrases that he's come out with. He's a tendency, Hamza Yousaf, to repeat back the language used by a reporter in a question in his answer, which means you end up with situations where I think one of his lines was, "No, I don't think that the S&P is acting like a criminal organisation or in a criminal way," and he ended up kicking the can every day a little bit further down the road. He was tending to make news. But having said that, he could have said nothing, and I think that would probably have been worse. I was told by one source that he was effectively, when Peter Murrell was arrested, it should be said, to the shock of everyone in the SNP, he was offered effectively two strategies by his spin doctors in Bute House. He was told, you can do one of two things. You can either speak to the media every single day or as much as you like, or you can keep them at arm's length and some, and ensure that you say as little as humanly possible. And to Hamza Yousaf's great credit, he chose option A and not option B. And as you say, it's been an interesting approach. I wonder, however, how much that is almost down to wanting to be seen as First Minister. You know, he's new to the role, he wants to have a public profile of it. But also, you know, it's not a bad time to learn how to do spinning. If you can't really make it any worse than it already is. I don't know what you think. I mean, the polls demonstrate a little slip in the SNP support. It's slightly accelerated since police have said that's only through one poll. But the SNP feel like they're on a decline. Do you think Hamza Yousaf's approach has accelerated that? Or do you think it'll be a more longer term decline for the party, if it declines at all?
I think one of the interesting things that was said to me by someone close to Hunter Youssef, who I think is probably the same source that said that information to you, was that in some ways he didn't have that much choice because of the geography of the Scottish Parliament. Essentially, there's a set of stairs and there's a lobby outside the Holyrood Chamber, and that's where all the journalists gather to doorstep, and he could have tried to get past them, but it would have been filmed, it would have been seen, it would have looked like he was avoiding questions. He could have tried to use another route, but journalists would quite quickly have clocked onto that. And again, it would have looked like he was kind of on the run, a kind of fugitive within the Scottish Parliament. It would not have been a good look for a new First Minister. So he kind of had to front up, maybe not to the degree that he's done, but he had to do it in some shape or form. So I think that's interesting, and I'm not sure the degree to which I can totally appreciate some of the criticism. I think Hamza Youssef is a good communicator. I think even his critics, who view him as kind of shallow or out of his depth, would admit to that. He is a good communicator. He shares that with Nicola Sturgeon, but he probably doesn't choose his words as carefully as Nicola Sturgeon does, and he does do that thing of repeating back a question. I think there was one another good example where he said the SNP were not in cahoots with the police, which immediately became the headline that a lot of newspapers used. But I think he is to some degree learning as he goes, and I think, you know, some people who criticise his language as stupid or, you know, ill thought out, I wonder how they would do if someone shoved a camera in their face every day and just asked them all these questions. You do slip up. It's a fact of life. I think people around him know that. Anyone who's involved in political communications knows that sometimes you do slip up. That's just the nature of these things.
Let's have a quick pivot away from the government, because Hamza Youssef repeatedly has said that he knew very little to nothing about the various scandals around the SNP's finance. But look at the party itself. Now, in the last week, we've had Ian Blackford and Stephen Flynn, you know, previous Westminster leader, current Westminster leader, going tete-a-tete, effectively, over the lack of auditors and who told who what and when. The SNP in Westminster is in a very potentially damaging position of not having any short money. That's public money that effectively funds their research team and their press team, and all of the parliamentary staff. And you've also got the problem of auditors at the main party also not having been appointed, alongside the drip feeding that seems to be coming out of the investigation about things like the motorhome, the 110k caravan that sat on Peter Murrell's mother's lawn for however long, and burner phones supposedly, or SIM cards at the very least, and fridge freezers, all of these allegations drip feeding out. It's probably, I don't think I'm overstating when I say this, it's probably the biggest crisis as a political party the SNP has ever faced.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I think the words that Mike Russell used even before some of these events actually was it's their biggest crisis in 50 years or whatever he said. But as a mainstream political party, a party of government, I think it's 100% the biggest crisis they've ever faced, just because there's so many different elements to it. It's, you know, really serious to have a police investigation ongoing. And I think you're quite right to point to those scenes in Westminster. I thought it was quite extraordinary to have the Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, and his predecessor, Ian Blackford, essentially at loggerheads over whether assurances were given about auditors being in place in time for that deadline. They've got that hard deadline in which they need to submit their audited accounts to get that short money, essentially. And if they don't have that, I think it's just 1.2 million, I think, or something like that. Yeah. If they don't have that, staff could be at risk.
The speed of... I think it's always worth stating to people that, you know, who maybe don't understand, is, you know, when we spend time in Holyrood, certainly in the last few years under Nicola Sturgeon, SNP MSPs are terrified of speaking to the press, or have been historically. It's not something they tend to do willingly unless you've got an existing relationship with them. That's completely changed in Holyrood in the last six weeks since the Nicola Sturgeon's resigned. You can speak to SNP MSPs very widely, but the speed at which that kind of self-imposed self-discipline that has been the character of the SNP, both in Westminster and in Holyrood for as long as they've been in government, has eroded at such a speed, it is genuinely astonishing to watch.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you've now got these backbench figures like Kate Forbes, you know, Fergus Ewing, who are quite willing to speak out on things. Fergus Ewing has obviously been a thorn in the side of the SNP's leadership for quite a while now. He will be quite outspoken about things. Kate Forbes will choose her language more carefully, but she's certainly someone on the backbenches who does not agree with some of the policies that Hamza Youssef will be pushing forward. on things like gender reform, but also on things like highly protected marine areas. Mm-hmm. She will be a bit of a thorn in the side about that, I think. So to have those kind of groups emerging is really different. And, you know, the SNP has always had politicians that will speak to the media, but they've also had politicians, who I remember getting in touch with an MSP before this all erupted, and they immediately sent what I had texted them to the party's press office, who then got back to me, which I just thought was quite strange behaviour. But there we go.
That's not normal behaviour, it should be said, for journalist, journalist and politician interactions. If we text them, it tends to be a personal relationship.
Unless it's something highly controversial. And I'm sure they let press officers know, but you usually expect to hear back from the MSPs themselves as well. But anyway, yeah, there was always this perception that they weren't that amenable to the media, that they didn't really want to speak out against the leadership, they didn't want to cause waves. And a lot of that seems to be changing. And I think from the point of view of the public, it's good to have backbenchers who speak out on issues. It's good to have, you know, whether you agree with them or not, it's good to have figures like Fergus Ewing who are not afraid to stand up and say to the Scottish Government, you've got this completely wrong. But from the point of view of the party, it's going to be a complete headache.
Let's talk briefly before we run out of time due to what's going on in this place in the SEC. But let's talk briefly about Nicola Sturgeon's appearance in Holyrood earlier this week. It was the first time she's been there and spoken to the press, the same day that Colin Beattie spoke to the press as well, since Peter Morrill's arrest. What did you make of her response? I thought it was quite interesting that, you know, she was asked about this, and we've alluded to it already, that she chooses her language very, very carefully. Now, I imagine she went over and over and over and over again what she was going to say in response to questions from the press. But she also came across as genuinely emotional, and someone who this investigation had impacted quite significantly. I think her phrase was that not in her worst nightmares would she have imagined the SNP in the situation they were in after her resignation. What do you make of that, first and foremost, but also throwing it forward a little bit and looking in the future? Where do you see her legacy ending up?
I share a lot of what you said there. I think she seemed genuinely emotional. Her voice was cracking at times. She was visibly emotional, particularly when she was talking about, you know, not her worst nightmares. She said the experience was very traumatic. I mean, I think, to be honest, if the police turn up at your door and arrest your husband, you are going to be, it's going to be quite a traumatic experience for you. So I think there was a lot of, she did choose her words carefully. I think it was interesting that she made it quite clear that the police investigation, she is saying, had nothing to do or wasn't the reason for her resignation in the middle of February. There'd been a lot of speculation that maybe she knew the police were stepping up their investigation and that played into why she decided to step down. She's saying that's not the case. She was also confirming that at the time of her speaking, she hadn't been interviewed by the police yet. Mm-hmm. So there was information that she was giving, but there was also quite a lot she couldn't say because of the ongoing police investigation. She wouldn't comment, for example, on the camper van at all, this camper van that the party bought, mm-hmm. supposedly worth about £100,000 mm-hmm. in the run-up to the 2021 Holyrood election, and then didn't use because the COVID rules changed. It was supposed to be a campaign battle bus. So, yeah, it was interesting. In terms of her legacy, I think it all depends on what happens. It's impossible to speculate on that kind of thing. And to be honest, I don't think we really should.
No, I think it is a live police investigation. It is live for the purposes of the Contempt of Court Act, so we have to be very careful about what we do say about it. That is all we've got time for here today in the Conservative Party Conference. Thank you very much, Alistair, for joining us this week. Thank you very much at home as well for listening. And we'll see you next week, hopefully back in our spiritual home of a random committee room in the Scottish Parliament. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.